the dance, the choreography that embraces us all and invites us to rejoin it. Pluto, the principle of death, rebirth, intensity, and also humming within all of us. We all have a mission. We all have something to do. Has entered Aquarius for the next 20 years, right? So it's not what's going to happen. It's what's available with which to cooperate, you know, to compost grievance into nutrient for grief. We'll honor this. The toxic mimic of community is a cult, which feeds on grievance, strife, and polarity, whereas actual community of the earth requires the kinship of grieving, a river that flows over and dissolves man-made imposed borders of strife, to the ocean, to Big Mama, a community of symbiotic mutualism from whence we all come and must remember. So here's our part two, the art of grief, hope, and wonder in the face of environmental collapse. Grief artfully expressed becomes a sacrament of kinship. Enthused and happy to re-welcome last week's guest, Aaron Cassel, science writer, musician with soul of poet, the author of The Mourner's Bestiary, oh, I can't recommend it highly enough, Lyrical Reports from the Apocalypse. The Mourner's Bestiary is a meditation on grief and survival, told through the stories of animals in two collapsing marine ecosystems, the Gulf of Maine and the Long Island Sound, and the lives of a family facing a life-threatening illness on their shores. The Gulf of Maine is the world's fastest warming marine ecosystem, and the Long Island Sound has been the site of conservation battles that predict the necessary, well, I changed some of the words here, the necessary, because there's so much fighting, right? I often change fighting to dedication, the necessary dedication ahead for the Gulf. Aaron Cassel carries a family legacy of 200 years of genetic kidney disease, raising a child who may also. The Mourner's Bestiary braids environmental research with a memoir of generational healing and the work it takes to get there for the human and animal lives caught in tides of loss. That's from your promo, which is pretty great. So welcome, Aaron Cassel. She disappeared, but we're getting her back. So here we are. I'll do a little fill-in while we're waiting for Aaron to rejoin us. The choreography, again, so heartening, but the reason I wanted to talk to Aaron is that grief is a giant cauldron in the earth. She knows grief so well. She writes about it and how to navigate it and what gets us through the underworld, all of us, you know, and the micro to the macro, our own personal lives, you know, and then the collective. I'll bring in now one of my favorite. Oh, she's back! She's back! You're back from the underworld. I'm so glad. Well, yeah, because I was just what gets us back from the underworld? Well, something. Aaron Cassel has returned to us. So I am. Because there's nothing more important than your dedication, which is grief and dancing and singing in spite of it. You know, we're dancing and singing no matter what, and I love that. And you speak about so many important things. Yes, the cats have taken my notes. That's my excuse, but. ancestors and ghosts. You know, you write, all my ancestors were with me, two centuries of drowning people, and all the doctors who have ever helped me find healing. There was the acupuncturist who told me, I can keep you away from dialysis for a long time. The Chinese are obsessed with the kidneys. Did he? Did he keep you away from dialysis for a long time?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I was diagnosed, it was the 1990s, and transplant technology was still relatively new, and dialysis had been around as part of a public health practice for almost 30 years by that point. But with the disease that I have at that stage, there weren't very many preventative things that you could do for it. There's a diet protocol that's really important in terms of, you know, at that point at least, believing that lower protein, definitely lower sodium diet would help prolong your kidney function. There were things like obviously exercise and trying to reduce your blood pressure, lots of things that were basic preventative medicine, but there was no medical protocol at all from Western medicine. for my illness. And while I was really well monitored and well cared for by the nephrologist who looked after me, there really was just a sense of, okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to prevent harm for as long as we can. You know, don't smoke, don't drink, all of those basic ideas. And, you know, at that point, as a young person in my 20s, I felt like there must be other things I could start doing in order to realign my relationship to my body, right? And so not only does that mean good therapy and, you know, I had a yoga practice for a while until my disease made that a little bit more difficult. And I found an acupuncturist very early on who was I still see him, is this wonderful combination of Western trained. He was trained as a microbiologist, and he did a lot of work in clinical settings around patients that were struggling with HIV and cancer. And he would meet them sometimes after they had been in these studies that he was working on. And they would tell him, oh, my protocols are great, but really only since I started acupuncture. So as a person with a really strong Western, you know, headspace about what healing looked like, he dedicated his life to becoming an acupuncturist. And I started seeing him in my late 20s. My father was still alive. And he was the one who said to me, we can figure out how to keep you healthy for as long as possible. He was the first person who also said, we can keep you healthy for long enough to have a child if you want to.
Oh.
And so it was like this lifeline of, okay, there's something that I can do. And for me, I mean, I know everybody's experiences are different. But, you know, I figured a 5,000-year-old medical practice probably had a few things to say about
yes.
keeping my body in one piece. And I felt immediate effects, and it was such a whole body experience that I felt like it was a really great partner to, you know, battling back the situational depression from the diagnosis. And from caregiving for my father while he passed away. It made me have a great pregnancy, fantastic outcomes. I was supposed to be high risk because of my kidney function when I was first assessed, and I had an absolutely picture-perfect experience of being pregnant and delivery. And, you know, and I'm 53. I have to check that every time. I'm like, how old am I? I'm 53. And, you know, at this point, everyone in my family was, if not passed away, my father lived into his 60s, but he was on dialysis early in his 50s, if not his late 40s. And, you know, so the health outcomes were always very much at this point, there was kidney failure. And I think a huge part of knowing that I had some options about how I could reorganize my way of thinking about the disease, it really stemmed from those conversations where he wasn't promising me perfect health, and he wasn't promising me that I wouldn't get sick from my disease eventually, and he wasn't promising that there weren't going to be negative health outcomes, but there was a story about the possibilities of surviving with a really high quality of day-to-day experience in my health that nobody was telling me in any other space. And, you know, I think that's been a huge part of creating an attitude in me that left the door open for a change in this sort of mindset of I'm going to have a curse and I'm going to be sick at this age and I'm going to have, you know, these experiences that are going to be really devastating. And yeah, I feel like, you know, if I believe I dedicated the copy of the book that I gave to him, to the fact that he has kept me alive all these years. I really believe that his work has been a huge part of it.
So you're still seeing him?
Yeah, I see him regularly.
Oh, that's wonderful. The ancient practices brewed with, I mean, we're in this riptide, right, of ancient meeting modern and science proving folklore and all of that. You know, yep. my brother-in-law was the head of NIH at one point, and he was he's a strict science guy. I mean, he thinks what I do is, you know, when will I get a job? But he's a good person. He's for the democratization of science. But at that time, he was the department of like what can we allow as alternative medicine? And he's like, acupuncture. Acupuncture, that's okay, because it's 5,000 years old. Crystals, no. Homeopathy gives all doctors conniption fits, like, and certainly the idea of Bobby Kennedy Jr. being head of NIH, or head of everything, and it just gives him, he's still having conniption fits. I can feel him telepathically. and my own acupuncturist, when I had my own, you know, underworld medical adventure, knock on wood, because you never know, right? We don't want to commit hubris, but... But he was so, you know, again, he said, well, there's something called battlefield acupuncture, and we might change the name, but it removes all fear. I'm like, oh, yeah, do that. Do that. Because I was hitting into all kinds of scary protocols. And then I was at that time, we worry about the things that turn out to be not, or some of us do. And I was like, oh, but I'll lose all my hair. And he's like, no, no, we'll do Designs of the Universe and henna on your skull. I'm like, yes, that's like your are you still singing? It's like, yes, defiant, defiant joy. Yeah. That's the spirit. So he plucked that up. And then I love that the word stamina comes from stamen, not the flower stamen, but it's the length of our life, the thread, the length of our life that the Norns weave, but the word means we can change it. Right? We can thicken it and lengthen it, going, thank you very much, and I'm going to improve on this now. What's your, you know, and you, you know, stamina is... You know, one of your many middle names, right? I mean, you have this strong dedication and driving from what you love. And as we're speaking now, Neptune, the ocean, dreams, vision, imagination, music, ocean, water, is rising due east in California, right on the horizon. We go, oh, that's great. So it knows you're here. Right. And it is rising, and it's retrograde, which is inward brewing. It's like the tide going out, and then it goes, or the tide, whatever, it's retrograde inward, and then it goes direct on December 7th, which is a day of mourning, you know, but then it goes outward. So just for fun, for you and for all of us to entertain the possibility that what we're crafting now, you know, out of concern and kinship for us all, and the wealth of Aaron Caffel's offering of what gets us through, you know, will then pour forth, and we go, all right, you know, and reality hits illusion. I love that. And then I'd sent you going about the zebrafish, right? Because that's a segue into your illness, and they were studying the zebrafish, and then. I'll let you narrate it, you know, but it's one of those things of, will we find the thing that heals us before we kill it, right? That's been true forever, like the Amazon, the thing that's like teeming with medicines and things, and the zebrafish, their plight. Do you want to introduce the? I have the book open, but if you want to introduce the zebrafish.
Well, the reason that I found out about the zebrafish is because I have a wonderful nephrologist now who is part of a huge network of folks who do specific scientific studies on the disease that my family carries. And so whenever I go see her for my regular updates on my physical health, we end up nerding out about anything that she's got from the scientific literature. And she knows about my work and my books. And I've come to do some support for the training that she does for her students, who she really insists on bringing into these spaces where she talks not only about the disease and the disease progression and the science of it, but also the holistic experience of the patients that are going to be coming across their thresholds in their experience when they're clinicians. She has this idea, and I think it's really true, that when you take care of someone with PKD, because it's a genetic illness, you are actually not just in the room with the patient, but you're in the room with the whole family. And whenever she treats me, that's how she treats me. It's a very holistic, whole person version of Western medicine. And when we were having a session a couple of years ago, she sort of found out a little bit more about what I was writing about and that mostly I wanted to talk about fish. And she said, oh, goodness, you know about the zebrafish, and started to tell me that there was this incredible study that was going on about the ability of zebrafish to do regeneration within their nephrons. And the nephrons are one of the key elements of the kidney that with my disease become damaged or sort of impinged upon and kind of beyond repair through the disease progression. And it's this sort of miracle that this fish that shares certain types of DNA with the human body has this incredible facility. And at the same time, zebrafish are also under enormous threat from warming oceans and warming freshwater and pollution. And so the question becomes for me, with that fish, you know, that's particular to my hopes and dreams for the future of treatment for my illness. But there are thousands of stories like that everywhere in terms of the things we haven't unlocked about the way that the natural world can support human health or planetary health. And sometimes those are completely new pieces of information that are part of STEM focus on disease progression and a very, you know, Western medicine focused version of acquiring knowledge about how the natural world and human bodies act in concert. But sometimes that's also indigenous knowledge is being lost by habitat loss, by development. You know, you're saying the Amazon, and I was thinking about this fantastic book that I reviewed a couple of years ago called The Life and Death of the Minke Whale. It's written by a Brazilian journalist that's absolutely fantastic and is a very lyrical, I think you would really appreciate, and so would your listeners, that book, because it's this incredibly lyrical examination of the incredible complexity of what happens to an ecosystem when it's under the threat and pressure of development, of deforestation, of climate change and collapse, you know, the ways in which the existing culture of the people who live there, the indigenous culture that's underlying that, the future culture of the people who are coming in, connect to things like healing practices and understanding of the land and the planet and ecology generally, and also story and history and lyricism and music and art. And I think it's just, it's a very slim book, but it's absolutely beautiful in the way that it lays out, you know, the complexity of a place that I probably will never get to go to, but that has a huge bearing on my day-to-day. And zebrafish, similarly, they are on the other side of the world from me. They aren't in the ecosystem that I write about or the one that I am closest to, but they could be a pathway if we can keep from losing them to some future understandings of the human body that would be really miraculous for people like me.
Well, and the book is called The Life and Death of the Minke Whale. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And it's by Fabio Zucar. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing his name since I don't speak Portuguese.
No, that's great. We will track it down. No, this is all conversing. And, you know, you write about the zebrafish, you know, that it's a low potential for evolutionary rescue in fish living at the edge of their thermal limits. Oh, right. It's like my late great friend Bob Goff said, the climate crisis is inevitable. Human adaptation is optional. Right? Will we? Well, that's part of your dedication, right? And cooperating with what we love and see in nature. I re-listened to the show we did last week because it's really good, you know, and I'm so glad you came back. It's very gracious and kind and generous of you. I want to mention the word generous. I was listening to a fascinating podcast on folklore used to be an agent of disinformation. Completely interesting. You know, and so we want the true folklore rather than the disinfolklore. But the narrator said, you know, right now in this complex time, you want to hang out in social media neighborhoods and neighborhoods in general that are full of generosity. He said, that's a good enough word for it. You know, is the narrative generous? You know, and there's the Dementors all full of, you know, meanness and everything. And we go, generosity and reciprocal blessing. Because where we were last week, you know, you in the cicada, you were having a walk with somebody in the cicada fest. I love them, and she said, "You greet everyone, you greet everything you meet. Hi, how are you?" And we went off on you know, participatory animism, which is I think the way to go. It's yeah. very you, and it's what's well, very all of us. And you know, and I found the thing that you said last night, and I found it in rereading your book here. We must recognize the wickedness of wasted time,
yeah.
the urgency and fear. Because we were talking about grief, and you said, I grieve for the wasted time. We go,
yeah.
okay. Well, then Neptune Dreams Vision Ocean has something to say to us, because it says, you know, and the wonder and curiosity that are your fuel that you carry. So Chinese acupuncturist ally Dr. Wu said, you know, in Chinese fairy tales, well, there's many kinds of time. And in Chinese fairy tales, it's called irrational time. And it's where you step through the hole in the tree into the fairy world, and hours and days, maybe weeks go by, and you come back to here 5 minutes. So do we have enough time?
Mm-hmm.
It goes, it depends on what kind of time, right? And so the time you spend in the ocean and the reverie, and you've gotten me rededicated to swimming, because it is an essential part of me and everything. And it's in that reverie, because, well, let me toss it back to you. But the reason I love swimming, and you narrate this so well, is that, you know, jogging is sort of so mortal. It's like one step. But swimming, you know, I usually do a mile, and the first third is, you know, you could stop now and go eat something. It's like, no, keep going, there we go. And the second third is like, oh, pretty good. And the last third is like, let's do this again. Dun, dun,
yeah, let's
dun.
Stop.
What, say what?
Yeah. Let's never stop.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Well, you find your rhythm, but also there's a trancey working out of things, right? Do you find that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I do. And you know, most of the places that I try to exercise, I feel like I want them to be spaces of immersion where I can not just disappear into my body, but also disappear into the space around me. And, you know, when I have the leisure time to drive outside of the city and go into a forest and do my walking there, that is an immersive experience, because I'm surrounded by all the inputs of information. And I'm a body, but I'm also in this space very intimately that is shared by all the other creatures, all the other plants. Just the experience of the air being different, because it's surrounded by forest. And when you're stuck in the city, as I am often, being able to go into water and be able to have my body disappear into that immersive experience is really necessary, because I feel like you don't have as much of a sense of yourself as a watery being as you do when you actually are immersed in water, because then your buoyancy kicks in and your sense of, you know, the sort of origins of our lives and maybe some sort of, you know, ancestral thing or even like pre-birth experience kind of, I feel like it just floods back into your body and you understand yourself to be a being of water in water. And so for me, there's the moving. There's, of course, I love the movement and it feels really good and the exercise feels good, but also the way in which some part of my limbic brain takes over and some part of my very chatty, very busy. I mean, I think you can tell from the work that I do that I always have a lot of different things on the boil, right? Lots of projects going. I usually write a couple of books at once. I tend to bore very easily, so I like to keep going. But that is a very chatty brain that only really slows down when I take my body to an immersive space. And so swimming for me feels like it's, you know, it's spiritual practice. It's closeness to the divine, but it's also this way of just recognizing, just in an extremely physical way, that I am a creature of nature in nature, in that space and time. And I feel like it's transporting, and like meditation, like you feel different when you leave the pool. You've altered your brain chemistry in some way while you're doing it.
Yes, and what I often say to my lazy self is like, you know, it's like, oh, it's very close to the pool closing time. It's like anything better than nothing. Anything really is better than nothing. Yeah, especially swimming.
Absolutely.
It's like, oh, that's much better. It rearranges. but you write, in the pool, I thought about helpful ghosts and I kicked harder. Yeah. That's so resonant. I moved faster through the water. I heard Mac's voice, felt the warmer. Yeah, I often think of the dead when I'm swimming and then there are moments of revelation. I in my daunting sort of orthodox but syncretized, you know, treatment did really well, unusually well. And one thing was I didn't lose appetite. And when I was swimming, I remembered my late great companion, Stella Coyote, an actual coyote that I lived with for 19 years. Mm-hmm. And when her best friend, the wolf dog, died, she loved him. But she taught me the difference between grief and sentimentality. And what it was she loved it. She clearly grieved, you know, but it increased her appetite for life, you know. Mm-hmm. And she was like, "You're dying. I love you more than life itself. I'm going to take your bone. Now you're dead. I'm so sad. And I'm going to live." Mm-hmm. And she gave that to me, right? I mean, I could feel it going, "Thank you." You know, all of us, you know, what gets us through the underworld? And it's like, well, everyone and everything that's ever contributed something useful to ourselves, that's part of what gets us through, right?
Yes, absolutely.
The ghost in the pool, I thought about helpful ghost. Well, let's think about helpful ghosts. Well, right now I'm, you know, that and when we spoke last week, I was just back from a week in California. Although it's really still with me. I mean, I think one of the things about traveling is that you're sort of expanding where you are. It's like part of me is still in California, and part of me, all of those experiences that we digest. But when I set forth the day after the election to go do radio and a talk and other things, I was like, well, I just want to stay home with the animals under the blanket. But working it and meeting with wonderful people is a good thing to do. And so I've been dusting off every trickster thing, every useful thing, everything from books and people and conversations that would be useful. And, you know, and in considering our conversation, Terry Pratchett is a wonderful animistic novel writer, again, an ancestor now, but his witch novels are great. And in one of them, the young girl witch, it opens with she's helping the old patriarch to die, and she's taking his pain away. And she says the first thing she learned in witchcraft was all about balance, how to let the pain flow through you, not into you. The center of the seesaw is neither up nor down, but upness and downness flow through it. Put that in my pocket.
You're picking out a favorite book that Dex and I listened to all of the Tiffany Aching books when we were obsessed with them. And part of why was, I think, that incredibly visceral and gentle way of thinking about what what healing looks like, that you are partially what you're doing is absorbing pain to remove it, but you can't absorb pain without thinking of what it translates into and where it goes. I love that image. I think about it all the time.
Oh, that's so great. No, the Terry Pratchett. Well, because, you know, as you are, Terry Pratchett's, those witch novels are profound and very witty and really relevant. And really, really relevant. You know, I use I Shall Wear Midnight, and it's true, and the Audible Brits have done a great job. And I've read that book a number of times, and then I listened to it driving home from the beach once, and I thought, if I had done only that, if I had, in my whole life, only written that book, that would be, like, enough.
That's enough.
Be enough. But he kept going, and it kept getting wonderful, and even when he was dying, he kept going. It was just, and so pertinent, it's such a gift, and just, you know, I use this all the time, but I think it's so pertinent now, because I Shall Wear Midnight, the cunning man has come to town and created mob mind, that is the rough music that causes people to do cruel, horrible things. And the young girl witch must address this, right? The reason I opened with the grievance theme is she says this crucial thing that I work with all the time, and I think we all should, you know. She said, the cunning man finds purchase in all whose hearts are full of grievance. And I go, that's right. The fate of the world requires humans dissolving grievance from their hearts, because that's how tyranny gets into all of us, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And I believe that we can't actually see properly what's happening to the planet without thinking through and moving through the emotional work of it. That if we ask people just to do an intellectual observation or an intellectual response of towards the science that's out there, towards the frightening things that are happening to the planet and its chemistry and its ecosystems, you know, I think that we lose a really crucial part of what it is to be a human in relation to the world, which is that we really need to be able to feel through what we're feeling, or else that response curdles and we can't look at it. And we have we have to figure out.
Yes, no, hold all those thoughts,
Right.
We're going to have our short musical break with your song, Useful to the Day. Yeah, no, it is lovely. And music and ocean and caring and what gets us through, you know, and you're extremely well put together. I guess it's Isabella, you know, little press package, but it's the best press package I've seen from any author.
It is.
And then it's good questions and then your answers. But how have your experiences as a musician impacted your writing process? Although I like to replace the word impact with influence, just because we don't want a short violent encounter. How have your experiences as a musician influenced your writing process? And you say, being a musician has made me think about language in a different way. My voice now incorporates the repetition of verse, chorus, verse, the insistence on imagery and phrase, and the complex and often circular structures of songs. I find that I write better when listening to music. I'm like, oh, that's a good idea. What a good idea. Yes, exactly. The rhythm and flow are as important to me as content, and that I want emotions to be conveyed through lyricism as much as direct address. Is there anything you want to say to us about Useful to the Day, which we're about to hear?
Oh, it's a lullaby. It's a lullaby that I wrote for my kid when things were very difficult in our lives, and that he refused to listen to for many years because it was too tender. So I listen to it for myself now. It turns out to have been a lullaby for me. It's a lullaby.
We'll come back on the other side to whales, lullabies, and everything, and you know how we can enter into the irrational time world. All right, so here's our wonderful guest, Aaron Kaufel's song, Useful to the Day. Here we go.
You You will surface with a deeper well. You will surface with a deeper well. You will surface with a deeper well.
That's a song from our guest, Erin Castle. That's beautiful. That's your lullaby song, yeah?
Yeah, that is. That is written when I couldn't sleep, and neither did my kid.
And I hope everybody gets a chance. You know, you might be driving in your car, or I was very honored years ago. The people harvesting cannabis said, "We always listen to your show when we're trimming." I go, "Oh, that's wonderful." So whatever you're doing, but I also your song through headphones is really worth it. It's like ooh, so wonderful. Yeah, and as we're gathering, and then I just wanted to to feast on a little bit that you didn't mind that I brought up last week, which is your Mercury's image is through imagination, lost opportunity is regained, and you're like, that's your middle name, you said. so through imagination, lost opportunity regained, and we go, yeah, you know, again, resilient pluckiness in the face of wasted time, and then collaborating with all we love. I mean, that's really part of your dynamic. You know, the concern with the zebrafish and then all the resilient creatures like the tardigrades, you know, the Sheldrake lads, Rupert's kids taught me about tardigrades, which are, they look like, you know, they're little microscopic,
little
like teddy bears. Yeah, they're water bears. They're very, very darling. At first, I thought they were making it up when they told me. But it's, but they're everywhere, and they can go into suspended animation. They don't mind NASA shooting them into space, or at least they haven't said they minded. They're resilient, and it's like, you know, all of these kin, you know, calling all of this. What can change things? And I wanted to, I mean, you do so well in The Mourner's Bestiary, again, a book I cannot recommend highly enough. I have unconflicted enthusiasm. Everyone, Erin Castle's book, The Mourner's Bestiary. It's so beautiful. I mean, really, I read the whole thing, and then I went back to sort of opening at random, like the I Ching, going, oh, that's really good. It's very rich, because, and it is the micro to the macro, and your personal ocean, your personal, you know, challenging diagnosis, and the hereditary nature of that, and then the whole larger world. And there's a mystery here. One of my favorite kind of client allies was a forensic psychiatrist, and her job was to go into crime scenes and maintain curiosity and kinship with the perpetrator. And she said sometimes she was called to a crime scene where children had killed their mother. And she goes, well, we are killing our mother. Where she went, which was, is that there is no strictly private anything, no private illness, no private crime. It's all part of the collective speaking to us. And then it becomes part of your assignment, in which you're really taking that. You're taking the micro of your circumstance and teasing it into, you know, again, the whole macro dynamic. It's I've seen people try this before, Erin Castle, but you do it best. You do it best, the micro to the macro. And in my own medical underworld, and I changed all the language just because I think diagnosis is useful to start the conversation, and then I want to throw it out and find the other story when I'm dealing with other people with daunting diagnosis, or even on occasion myself. So what I said is, I have been diagnosed as having inappropriately enthusiastic cells. So my job is to out enthuse them, you know. And then I kept looking, you know, even in the kind of conventional doctor world, going, what's the story? I need a story so I can cooperate with it. And one sort of beguiled but exasperated doctor said, well, here's the story. These cells have lost the capacity to cooperate, so they have no respect for boundaries. I'm like, there's the story. That's huge wonderful. Story.
It's huge.
Wasn't it? I mean, yeah. It's huge. That, that, no, it's that's like, true. This is pertinent everywhere. This is pertinent everywhere.
Yeah.
And so in my own protocol, I'd go, you pour, like, how do you dance with demons? So, and I had another friend, doctor, going through a similar thing. And it's like, well, how do you dance with demons? And it's like, and compassion for demons. And it's like, you pour little cells that have lost the capacity to cooperate into the cauldron of oblivion in my body and the body politic, right? And that seemed to work pretty well. And then the doctor chimed back in saying, to be reborn is the energy to regenerate forests. I'm like, now we're talking. You know, that everybody who works their own daunting assignment, you know, it is connected to the collective, you know, and and your own stamina. Because I look at your chart and I go, you are so strong. I mean, and you are really, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of my my gifts is that I am stubborn and I'm very forthright and I have endurance. I'm kind of obsessed with Ernest Shackleton, and part of becoming obsessed with Ernest Shackleton was realizing that his ship was called the Endurance. Like, I love that as a as a trait and as a quality in humans. And I think, you know, I think one of the things that's been a real gift of the process of coming to terms with my own language around my disease and my own storytelling around it has been to harness that very stubborn energy of, you know, I will be able to endure and also I will thrive as much as possible in the future that I've been given, in the time that's been handed to me, but also just trying to stay as curious in that endurance as possible. I think one of the things that I love talking about Ernest Shackleton, which I do in some of the songs that I wrote in the last record that I put out, was, you know, I've got a line that says, I love the violin. And part of that is because the Shackleton expedition brought a violin. And when they were trapped in the ice, one of the things that Shackleton made sure happened was that the men had nightly salons where they would speak to each other about their expertise. They would show color slides. The photographer would show images that he'd been taking. People would report about what they were reading. And there was a violin and a violin player, and people would sing and play together. And so, you know, there's a fate where people are stuck in the ice for multiple years without really a sense of how they're going to get rescued or what's going to happen. And it's the kindness and the cohesiveness and the sense of joy within the endurance that is so important, that enables people to stay together to try to work towards a collective higher good, right? We need to be able to figure out what that looks like. And it's not just sitting on the ship frozen in the ice, right? It's sitting on the ship frozen in the ice and figuring out how to have the violin there too, how to have the singing, how to have the story that tells you that this experience will be transmuted into new understanding. And for me, every time that I've run up against a new layer of loss from the illness, which, you know, that happens all the time. It's a progressive disease. I'm constantly losing little pieces of what I used to be able to do. But every time it's to recognize that it is frightening to be stuck in the ice, and also that it's possible to find ways to connect outside of that or through it or deeper into it that begin to be the doorway to, I mean, and I say this in the book, the doorway to joy. We have a complex relationship to all of the things that are happening around us all the time. And we really don't know much of the time what is operating in the background for our benefit, personally, or for the collective benefit. And trying to find ways to remember that through something as simple as music is the only way forward that I can keep going back to with any facility.
Well, I love that Shackleton loved the violin, because the violin, it's, you know, as you were speaking, I could almost hear it. I could almost hear Shackleton playing it, you know, and it's kind of whale-y, right? We don't know how the whales are responding, but the music to and fro, you know, and you'd brought up the periwinkles. Remind us, what are periwinkles? Because people go, those flowers. No, but periwinkle as a kind of mollusk, is that what it is?
Or? Yeah, they're a snail. And
a snail.
There are multiple species that are part of the eastern seaboard. Two of them are native snail species that are part of the Atlantic Ocean ecosystem. And then there's an invasive species or a what is it? Oh my gosh, there's a phrase that's not invasive that I've that's just gone out of my head that's so good about species, instead of calling them invasive, which is a very like colonizer language, but rather, you know, they're here yeah. accidentally. That's their fault that they're in this location. But they're just a little world, like it's the kind of snail you'd find at the beach, or in the tide pools or on rocks at the ocean. And when I was traveling in Maine, I mean, I've seen them my whole childhood myself, but I met someone in Maine who taught us to sing to them as well. And that was a real eye-opening experience of, you know, holding something that you know is in small ways wreaking havoc on the ecosystem because it's in a place it's not supposed to be originally. And then also it's this wonderful, magical creature that can teach you about wonder in its
Well, because you said, you know, singing to the periwinkle makes them curious. It's so
yeah.
charming. It's so charming. And I love, again, another ancestor. I hope all our ancestors meet. All the former guests of this show, I hope they're all having, who have died, I hope they're all having tea backstage. But Stephen Buhner was a great herbal, let's see, biomimicry guy. But when I first heard him, and then we talked about this a lot on the show, but he said, you know, what we call invasive plant species, it's lacking in manners. He said, I can mm-hmm. walk around somebody's house and look at the weeds growing outside and diagnose their illness because the weeds are showing mm-hmm. up to heal them. I'm like, oh, that's mm-hmm. great. Okay. And he said some of the, like what's called invasive, like the, I forgot which one it is, but in the Pacific Northwest, there's this invasive plant, but its specialty is healing depression and alcoholism. Going, thought you could use this. No, don't kill me. Don't anyway. So yeah, I love that there is a synchronous dance. Well, the zebrafish, right? So they were maligned for, you know, no fault of their own in cargo ships mm-hmm. and then clogging things and everything. But then in your mm-hmm. narration, it's so poignant because even in their home, where they came from is no longer habitable, right? So it's like mm-hmm. zebrafish. But they were swimming towards your mind going, I might have a mm-hmm. I might have a cure for your illness. And I was thinking about our discussion last week, you know, when we talked about water and the ocean as your connection with the divine. Yes, yes, yes. I said, you know, you have no water in your chart, right? And you know, and mm-hmm. water completes you. And you know, we riffed on that a little bit. But it was and then your body has too much water, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. part of the thing. And I was remembering that there's a Peruvian saying that the job of the women is to tell the men, we have enough. Stop hunting. We have enough. It's a boundary thing. You know, it's a boundary thing. It's like, we have enough. You know, Aaron's got enough water. Thank you. Thank you
yep.
very much. That's enough. That's enough. We're invoking boundaries. And it's a good day to do it. Just, you know, your mm-hmm. prodigious output and dedication, you know, gets a lot of support. And just for the fun, you know, Venus in the sky right now in Capricorn, the beautiful and the useful. And its image is a woman sitting in front of a blazing fireplace, the unconditional dedication of the self with all of its skills. And we go, right. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly connected to Saturn in Pisces, the teachings of the ocean, right? They're in cahoots. And Saturn's image is a sword and a stone. And it says to everybody, mm-hmm. but it also says to Aaron going, here, before your mind's eye, there's a sword and a stone. It's customized. It's only a stone for Aaron Kaffel. You can draw it forth. You know, while you're in irrational time, the fairies have all kinds of gifts, and it's a sword not of harm, but of truth and revelation and waking up humans, this community of the earth that must emerge, you know, the Middle East and where Israel is now, you know, the River Jordan begins in a cave sacred to Pan. It's like, let's go further back. Let's go further back. Mm-hmm. And you know, that whole land is a huge migratory pathway. It's like humans, it's not just humans being horrible and cruel to humans. It's like there's everybody here, and Aaron's got her eye on you. You know, it's like it's everybody, but let's go back to the ocean and go back to Pan. And another reason I was glad to Kahoot today, too, is, you know, the the Irish, the Celts, they don't say, I felt sad, you know. They go, or grief, they go, the grief is upon us. The sadness was upon me, which I think is, because it, almost in a Terry Pratchett way, it gives the grief and the sadness a living individuality. Hello, you know, hello, darkness, my old friend. Hello, grief. And so we are in grief over the election and the cauldron of grief in the world and Gaza and the Sudan and Ukraine and on and on. And our, and as you bring to us our flora, fauna, fungi, kin, you know, I did a radio interview a long time ago. It's really great, though, with Janine Benyus. And at that time, I think the interview was in 2008, but it could be yesterday. You know, there's the Wendell Berry poem, you know, when fear for the world, I'm going to get it wrong, but is with me, I go and lay down with the woodrake, with the creatures who do not burden themselves with forethought of grief. And I said to Janine, I go, I'm not sure that's true. Yeah, I'm not sure that the creatures don't have forethought of grief. And she goes, yeah, me too. And yeah. She said, all of the earth, you know, all of the creatures are holding their breath, like, what are the humans going to do?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's why it's like, oh, we're so sorry. And that's why, again, your rousing thing is like, well, all the more, you know, we just got to gather our pluck. And then just to give you a little more of the beauty of your chart, your Venus in Aries, zero Aries, the equinox degree, its image is a woman emerging from the sea, a seal is embracing her. Isn't that nice?
That's beautiful.
Part of your day. Yeah. And then you have irresistible eloquence of your plucky dedication spiraling out into community. You have a quintile to your north node and the capacity to open portals between worlds. So can we think of this book, this offering that took you 10 years to write? I mean, I wish everybody's books took 10 years to write. I think that's that should be a sort of Saturn boundary. Let's settle down, everybody, you know, and cook it for 10 years. But could it be, you know, again, it's so it's very dedicated, you know, and David Graeber spent 10 years writing his book, the Dawn of Everything, with dedication. So your dedication also is to see the micro and the macro. But how would you, if you could have a fervent blessing wish that would become true on December 7th, just for the fun of it, what would that be?
It would really be that people were able to do this work of moving from fear into wonder and back again more easily, because I think that planetarily we are in a place where we are getting stuck. We're getting stuck in these spaces where we are immersed in fear, immersed in even in grief or panic or rage, and those things are static, and we are sort of bumping up against each other in those spaces of immobility. And I think what I would want for everyone was to be able to cultivate the ability to move from those devastating feelings of recognizing what's happening, the fear that we have for the people that we love, the grief we have for the planet, but to be able to figure out how to move out of that enough so that we can find the energy and the wonder and the joy and the kindness and the generosity that can help us move forward. Because I don't think we don't do good work out of a place of being stuck. And, you know, that muscle has been the thing that's helped me figure out how to survive the worst news that I could have imagined at the time for my own life. It's that ability to telescope back and forth. And if I could make a blessing that everyone was able to access that, that it was a skill we could collectively possess, I think that the world would be infinitely better. Because every single problem, it's such a collective set of issues that we're dealing with right now. It's not just climate collapse. It's not just the right gaining power. It's not just settler colonialism and extractivist culture. It's not any one thing. It's this combination that really results from this panic that we don't know how to feel secure and whole in our own selves, because we can see this wider mechanism working that makes us feel afraid.
Yes. Well, you know, and also, you know, when you reference, you go, you know, my disease, you know, and the prefix dis, D-I-S, D-Y-S, means underworld. And the underworld was not always thought of as a bad place, only once priests got hold of it and made it hell. So any dis was considered a journey to the underworld where our souls could speak more deeply to us. And I've been thinking about that, you know, and, you know, because people used to say, I'm so disappointed. It's like, oh, you're powerless in the underworld, are you? Or you're having an appointment in the underworld, either way. But dis-ease is interesting. It's like, I'm in the underworld of ease. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I just you know, and dismay, you know, it's like, but it was thought of as, you know, something to be honored. You know, I'm going to a deep place where my soul can speak to me, and, you know, and in that way. So I did send you some of the permanent mourning allows us to change and change, that paragraph, and so you might have it in front of you. I have it in front of me, but it, so that paragraph and the following are just so wonderful. Do you want to read them? They're your words.
Absolutely. I'll read them. Okay. This is from page 288. Permanent mourning allows us...
Never mind me. Yeah. That's right.
Okay. Permanent mourning allows us to change and change and change again, evolving a way out to the future. Mourning as I am, I feel tumbling out of my mouth faster than I can say them, the names of all the animals in the places I love. They are the 100,000 names of the dead on the cover of a newspaper, etched on a marble war monument, black crepe over the former site of a glacier. We are witnesses in the dark, doulas for the birth of the world without the dead. Legacy comes with new life and structures you cannot see unless you peel back layers. The overgrowth of algae was a threat to fisheries, to bivalves, to carbon, to swimmers, to copepods in one generation and the next. The overgrowth of cysts were a threat to the pharmacist, his child, to my father, written in epigenetics and memory and sitting on me like a hungry ghost, a mystery, a fear. On the other side, there is new life. I have seen the births that follow loss.
That's so wonderful. And we don't quite have time for the following paragraph. I'll just read it. The cost of the collapse is hard. The mourning never leaves, but the chance at opening, transcendence, power, change are all there in the whirlpool if we choose to see them. Well, thank you so much, Erin Kaffel. You are a prodigious, indefatigable swoosh of generosity. You know, and I think we can feel ourselves etched against your dedication, going, you're making us all better people. Thank you. Thank you so much, Erin Kaffel. And her really wonderful, profound book, The Mourner's Bestiary, by Erin Kaffel, is available. Thanks always to Kirsten Thomas. I'm Caroline Casey. I will put the outtake notes in Patreon, Visionary Activist Show Patreon. So again, thank you, Erin Kaffel.
Thank you.
We can be next week. Bye.